BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Sinead Cusack continues reading from The Woman Who Shot Mussolini by Frances Stoner Saunders. In May 1927, a year after she'd barely wounded the dictator, Violet was released from prison in Italy into the care of her sister Constance on a condition that she was to be confined permanently into an institution for the insane. Violet was not made aware of the condition or of the destination her family had in mind.
Violet was in the lunatic asylum she so dreaded before either she or the press had time to catch up with events. On one of the forms completed by Constance on the night of Violet's admission, question 7 asked, "Was there any cause for the attack of insanity, such as illness, family trouble, poverty, drink or immoral habits, love affair, religious excitement, sunstroke, fright or injury?" In reply to which, Constance had written, "Religious excitement, fostered by hysterical friends, was probably the chief cause." Violet may have been following God's orders when she set out to kill Mussolini, but her political conscience was squared to the task. She believed that Mussolini was a totalitarian dictator who used violence and intimidation to acquire and hold on to power. She resented his and the Pope's betrayal of Christian socialism. Was Violet mad? Or was she pretending to be mad in order to execute a political agenda? Try as they might, those charged with deciphering her could not break her code. Founded in 1838, Northampton General Lunatic Asylum initially provided accommodation for pauper idiots. By the 1870s, most of these inmates had been moved to a county asylum, and the name was changed to St. Andrew's Hospital for Mental Diseases. The new clientele were fee-paying, chronic ladies and gentlemen, the well-heeled in need of healing, afflicted by what was described as moral disorders such as anxiety, trouble, disappointment in love, fright, jealousy, pecuniary difficulties, religion, novel reading, and spiritualism. What was the matter with Violet? The trouble with Violet, as far as the doctors could ascertain in initial interviews, was that she was suffering from expansive delusion. She was exalted in her ideas and perverted in her judgment. One note reads, "Abnormally self-satisfied, she considers herself a heroine and imagines herself the darling of the Italian people." There are letters in Violet's file, letters written by Constance to the medical superintendent and his staff, letters written to Violet by friends, and letters written by Violet herself. Disturbingly, and in contravention of the 1890 Lunacy Act, the presence in the file of the originals suggests that many of these were never sent. A month after her arrival, Violet wrote to a friend, "So let's talk realistically for a moment. I am sure that I can live an active life as long as it is clear that I have extremely delicate health." Her thoughts were not of spending the rest of her years at St. Andrews, knitting, killing time. The question was, how could she get out? She still had things to do in the world outside, and she spoke often of her deep regret that her attempt on Mussolini had not succeeded. On the night of the 4th of April, 1928, Violet started to shriek that the devil was in her room. Several days later, she became wildly excited, seized a broom, and used it freely on those about her. After a violent struggle, she was overpowered and the broom was removed. She was injected with morphine sulfate and removed to a silent room. padded cell. "Why," a doctor later asked, "did you hit Mrs. Lee about the head?" The questioner was punished for his pedantry. Violet's reply was unassailably logical. "I am like a gentleman. I cannot hit below the belt." Other episodes followed. A month later, she called out to nurses in the night and told them she had actually seen the devil in her room. For her, the only prophylactic against the devil was the Catholic rite, and this she was denied in St. Andrews. "Her family had left her to fall into wicked hands," she wrote to Enid Dinas in September 1928. "I feel that I have no friends. I don't know if there is still anyone who loves me. Help me to understand my situation." Dinas did not reply, because she never received the letter. It is still in Violet's file. For several months, beginning in early 1930, Violet secretly collected scraps of cloth that she slowly and carefully fashioned into a rope. But the rope was not for escaping. It was a ligature for killing herself. At 9:18 p.m. on the 2nd of April 1930, she was found in her room with a noose tightened around her neck. The nurse immediately released the rope and called for a doctor. Violet all the time was conscious. In her medical notes, dated the 7th of April, is the following entry. "Red mark around neck, but no further injuries. Determined attempt or carefully staged to create a distraction and sympathy." Despite being kept very closely supervised during the early years of her confinement, the psychiatric assessment to which she was subjected yielded no insight. Violet may have had difficulty in discerning the real from the false, but so did her doctors. It would come to the point where one of them dismissed her claim that she had shot Mussolini as a symptom of chronic delusion. On the 10th of June, 1940, from the balcony of Palazzo Venezia, Mussolini delivered his speech declaring war on France and England to an enormous crowd. It was a wild performance. His voice issued like a machine gun, hammering, clamorous, peremptorily insistent. He rolled his eyes, puffed out his cheeks, and pummeled his chest. Violet Gibson, long ago dismissed by the fascists as a barren old hag, was once again ready to pitch herself into the fray, writing lucidly, in a steady hand, to Mussolini's erstwhile admirer Winston Churchill. Her ideas were not grandiose or fantastical, but pragmatic points to explore in case they had been overlooked. Violet also had concerns about public morale and declining standards of integrity. "I myself am a victim of this state of things," she wrote. "In 1926, I tried to assassinate Mussolini. 1 year internment should have been ample for that. But because, for every 2 years I can be kept here, £1,000 clear profit is made, I have not been set free." Mindful of how busy Churchill must be, she asked him to get his secretary to write a line to the superintendent of this place, saying that something genuine and practical must be done to facilitate my release. The letter, together with its unstamped envelope, remains in the file. In early 1942, Violet's brother Willie died. The baronetcy passed to his nephew, Edward Russell Gibson. On the 21st of May, he received his first briefing from the medical superintendent of St. Andrews. "You may be interested to note that your aunt still takes a lively interest in current events and is now convinced that the incident which led to her admission to the hospital was entirely justifiable, and she is satisfied that events have proved it so." On the 28th of April, 1945, the bullets finally reached Mussolini. According to the accepted version, he and his mistress, Clara Petacci, died at 4:10 p.m. at the gates of a villa overlooking Lake Como. Mussolini apparently cried, "Aim at my heart!" His autopsy report suggests a less heroic final gesture. Two entry-exit perforations of the right arm indicated attempted bullet deflection by the victim. In November 1946, a friend from Violet's youth, Countess Winterton, wrote to the medical superintendent of St. Andrews to ask if she was still a patient there. The Countess explained that, "During a recent illness, I had a nurse who was her nurse for 2.5 years, and she cannot understand why Miss Gibson was not let out when we went to war with Italy. Naturally, at the time she shot Mussolini, to say she was mad was the only way to get out of an awkward situation. But she cannot have been certified now for that." The medical superintendent explained, "With advancing years, she is now more or less constantly confined to bed, but she is mentally still alert. After so many years' residence here, she is now more or less resigned to her position." Violet, after 2 decades in a lunatic asylum and now 70 years old, was in no way resigned to her position. She continued her campaign for release and to be moved to a convent. Constance was finally relieved of her responsibilities for Violet in October 1952, when Edward Vice Admiral Lord Ashbourne begrudgingly assumed the position. To his relief, there were few visits left to undertake. By late 1954, Violet, now 78, was dangerously weak. Her mordant wit was still in play, however. "I am at once alive and not alive. A unique state," she told a doctor in December. The slide continued for several more months, and in March 1956, Ashbourne was advised that she was now very frail. On Wednesday, the 2nd of May, 1956, at 12:45 a.m., Violet Gibson, the woman who shot Mussolini, died. As per Lord Ashbourne's request, there was no public announcement of Violet's death. There was no friend, no member of the family present at the burial, not even Constance, who was too frail to make the last journey to Northampton. She died 3 years later. Ashbourne himself declined to attend. Settling the question of his aunt's remains and the closing of her affairs, by correspondence. In her will, Violet had set aside £100 for the erection of a gravestone. In this, as in everything else, she was shortchanged. Above her grave, plot number 12411, is a bland cross in cheap grey quarry stone. Its inscription, "Violet Gibson, 1876 to 1956, full stop," is equally parsimonious. The punctuation is highly unusual, the result of the stonecutter following Ashbourne's text, which was communicated by telegram. The comma. It suggests something to follow, a sentiment perhaps, a memento mori, or words that supply a brief record of the life. A comma is a breathing space, a tiny pause before a further thought. Nothing follows the comma on Violet's gravestone, except the dates of her birth and death. Full stop. Set in stone. Her extraordinary story lies hidden between the comma and the full stop. The Honourable Violet Gibson deserved better.
Sinead Cusack has been reading from The Woman Who Shot Mussolini by Frances Stoner Saunders. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production. Throughout next week at this time, we turn to Martin Stannard's biography of one of the 20th century's finest writers, Muriel Spark. It's based on full access to her letters and papers, and it begins on Monday afternoon at 2:45 and again on late Monday night at 1:45.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, it's Steve Urquhart with you at 3 o'clock. It was almost 2 years in the making, and Sigmund Freud declared it the most magnificent novel ever. Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov continues in a moment. Mel will be celebrating the Great British Biscuit in the 4 o'clock show. And later, the Comedy Club opens with some glorious bits of Fry and Laurie. That's tonight at 10. So now let's return to Dostoevsky's philosophical novel focusing on family relationships. Following yesterday's violent encounter at the Karamazov home, Dmitri flees the town in search of Grushenka. Paul Hilton stars as Dmitri and Karl Prekop as Alyosha in The Brothers Karamazov.
Value your life. Don't lie.
Sir!
She's not here, is she?
She's not here! No, sir! Have pity, Dmitri Fyodorovich! Have mercy!
Where is my Grushenka? I must see her!
She's gone, sir! In a carriage! The officer sent for her. She went!
Officer? What the devil do you mean, officer?
The Polish one! Her first... friend! The one who scarped all those years ago. He repented, wanted her back, and can't breathe!
Oh, my apologies, old man. I'm calm. See how calm I am.
She's got pneumonia. Please, don't kill me.
Do you know what's on my hands?
Don't know. Don't want to know.
That's blood.
How'd you get blood on your hands?
In the usual way, I fear.
Don't tell me.
It's human blood. It's an old man's blood. For her. I did it for her. And she's gone. What officer?
Polish. That's all I know. Please.
Don't be afraid of me. I warn you.
Sir.
She used to comb my hair. Call me her Mitienka. Will you remember me in your prayers?
Night and day.
Now, what do I need now? Pistol and the hire of a carriage.
There are no guns in this house.
No, but there is one at my lodgings here. Here, just have some money. Well, did I ask you to pray for me?
You did. Blood on his hands. He's done it. Done what? Killed someone, of course.
Are those the best horses you have?
They are.
Oh, you're a liar. I could blow your brains out.
Why aren't they harnessing the damn horses?
They're afraid of you, sir.
Oh, and you're not.
Harness them, you fool. I have to go. I have to finish this. I have to...
Are you ill? Will I call for a doctor, Dmitri Fyodorovich? I'd be very happy to call for a doctor.
I am not ill.
Oh, I'm tired. I'm very tired. For 2 kopecks, I would lie down in the stable...